I'm going to just do three. I didn't put the mic on yet because I'm about to do prostrations. So I'm going to do three prostrations. I think Donna probably is too. And so we invite you to do three prostrations with us if that is part of your practice. If it is not, we are going to get started shortly after that. So.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with our prayers. So we want to turn to page 34 in the Gold Prayer Book. And if you have the white folder, it's on the white page with the prayers on it, which is a little self-explanatory. So we'll start with the Shakyamuni Buddha mantra three times. Taya ta mune mune maha munae soha. Taya ta mune mune maha munae soha. Tayata mune mune maha munaye soha. And now we recite the medicine Buddha stanza and we'll chant the mantra seven times. Bhagawan, with equal compassion for all, whose name when merely heard dispels the suffering of the lower realms, dispeller of disease and the three poisons, I prostrate to medicine Buddha, lapis light. Teata om beckon say, maha beckon say, raja samud gate soha. Teata om beckon say, maha beckon say, raja samud gate soha. Teata om beckon say, maha beckon say, raja samud gate soha. Teata om beckon say, maha beckon say, raja samud gate soha. Teata om beckon say, maha beckon say, raja samud gate soha. Teata om beckon say, maha beckon say, raja samud gate soha. Teata om beckon say, maha beckon say, raja samud gate soha. And now we'll say the four immeasurables in English. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And now we'll flip the page to page 37. And we'll chant Chenrezig's mantra eight times and Green Tara's mantra seven times. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om Tari Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha. So as Erin mentioned, Geshe-la's away this weekend, and we're going to do a little presentation or a little discussion. I'm Donna Cease. I'm the Spiritual Program Coordinator for Kadampa Center, and Erin is?
A student of Kadampa Center for a long time. Now I'm on? Okay. All right. So, Donna and I are talking today about the Four Noble Truths. The topic is the Four Noble Truths. Many of you probably know this as Buddhist first teaching, and you probably even know all the words and can recite the Four Noble Truths. Why do we continue reflecting on the Four Noble Truths? It is said that the minimum advantage that we get from studying the Four Noble Truths is that we develop confidence, some kind of confidence, that the problems and difficulties in this life can be stopped. So I see that as incredibly valuable, to have, you know, some kind of confidence to not be discouraged, to continue on our path, to have faith. And it's said that studying these Four Noble Truths do bring us that. In addition, if we really take this into our heart, we really develop a sense of refuge in a sense of confidence in the teachings. This leads us to refuge in Dharma and then Buddha and then Sangha. So it can really deepen our feelings of refuge. In our tradition here, we do these teachings in along with a thought of bodhicitta. So I'm going to lead us in a short meditation. And it's going to be a lot of just like centering kind of with some thoughts of benefiting others. If you have a deeper bodhicitta motivation that you want to do that along with this guided meditation. Then we're going to discuss the Four Noble Truths. We're going to make you work and do a little brainstorming. And we are going to then kind of talk about applying those noble truths with our daily difficulties. That's going to be the last part. So, as we do, we'll start with a little meditation. So, if you want to just get comfortable, even if you've got to sit up straighter, you don't want to be getting uncomfortable. So, when we say lengthen your spine and sitting up straight and pulling your... Is anyone brand new to the Kadampa Center? I should have asked that. A couple people. All right, welcome. So sometimes I feel like I want to skip over these things that you've heard a million times before, but so I'll try not to do that since there's at least a couple new people. So when we're sitting for meditation, we really want to sit in an upright position so that we can have really good breathing, so that our energy can flow, and so that we can really settle. If you're sitting in a chair, especially if your feet are flat on the floor, if you need a little cushion or something to make that happen, feel free to find a cushion. We'll take three deep breaths to get started. So bring to mind a positive reason for being here at the center, for discussing these topics, and for doing this meditation. Have the wish that this meditation will be beneficial for yourself and for others. That this meditation will bring a greater peace and happiness, as well as more positive thoughts and feelings. We'll start with just an awareness on our breath. So as your breath travels in and out of your nostrils, you can focus on the air coming in at the tip of your nose. It's warmer going in, a little cooler going out. You can stay there with your concentration, or you can follow your breath as it goes all the way into your abdomen. Extending your belly and contracting your belly. And if you want to focus on that, said to be very grounding, to focus on your abdomen. The breath in your abdomen. So at times your mind will wander and you want to just disengage from whatever other thoughts are coming up. Disengage from the stories and the planning and your thoughts about your physical body, what feels good and what feels bad. And if you want, you can even count your breath, starting with the exhale, and then the inhale, and then count one. Exhale and inhale again, and then count two. So before we open our eyes, if you're one that has heard this, these Four Noble Truths many times before, you know that the actual statements can seem simple. But as we talk today, reflect deeply. Are there moments when we actually recognize that worldly pleasures are suffering, transitory, illusory? In those moments of recognition, can we feel our cravings subside? Can we feel our grip on grasping at ourself loosen? How can we increase our understanding of the things that Buddha told us, so that we can see this suffering without being overwhelmed? And if these are new ideas, think of having an open mind, an open heart. And again, wanting for what we do here today to benefit ourselves and others. Positive energy that we can create is called merit in Buddhism. This is the cause of all of our happiness, and we can share it. So in this moment, we'll just dedicate any of the positive energy from this meditation for that same goal and purpose. May this meditation and the rest of our discussion here today be the cause of greater peace and happiness and benefit to ourselves and others. And now we can open our eyes. Now we're on the First Noble Truth.
Okay. So we're going to start with just doing a little bit of brainstorming and thinking about what these mean, and we're going to, what we're going to do with the Four Noble Truths is we're going to brainstorm about the first two, the truth of suffering and the truth of cessation. And then we're going to do a little, truth of origin.
Yeah.
I'm jumping ahead. I want to get to that cessation as quickly as possible. But we'll meditate a little bit about what cessation is like. And then the fourth truth is the path, and we're not going to do too much about that here this morning because everything else we do at Kadapa Center is about the path. We want to start out very open-ended, and I see that most people in the room have been around for a little while, and so as we start trying to brainstorm, we want to kind of throw it open, and we all know sort of the textbook answers to what is suffering and what are the causes, and we're going to try to avoid that. So maybe we'll start off with just if you've been around for a while, maybe just take a back seat for a moment, and we'll kind of throw everything out really open-ended, and then we'll all come in. And instead of passing the mic, we're going to give Susie a chance to relax, and you all can just holler out what you have to say, and Aaron and I will repeat it into the mic.
Yeah.
So for our friends who are streaming, all three of them. Okay, so the first noble truth is dukkha. That's the Sanskrit word. And it's frequently translated into English as suffering, which is kind of a gross translation, not gross in the sense of disgusting, but gross as in not much subtlety in it. But let's talk about what that would look like. How do we experience, what are the different things that we experience in life that we might consider to be suffering of some kind?
Always wanting more.
Always wanting more.
Jealousy.
Yeah.
Fear of the unknown. I'll call them out since you can put your mic down even if you want, until you need it.
Worry.
Loss is a good one.
Attachment.
Anxiety.
Desire.
FOMO. So FOMO, fear of missing out. It's a new one. Buddha didn't. Maybe Buddha knew about that one. I don't know. FOMO, fear of missing out. Yeah.
Yeah.
sickness and illness. Sickness, illness. Yeah, Octavia? Yeah, so jealousy's up there. So that's one that we...
Depression,
anger. Yeah, so we've got depression, anger, and the next one is loss of control. Yeah, not hatred. And then we'll give Donna a second to get hatred. Yes, Octavia?
Frustration.
Yes. I don't really know what category. Yeah.
Some of them are obvious categories.
There was a plan to maybe put things in categories, but
you can tell that.
No, frustration's a good example. We had a plan for how to write them on the board, which may or may not be working out. Irritation. Rabina calls irritation anger light. Yeah, so I think she says don't, you know, that's still anger, right?
Aversion.
Mm-hmm. Death is a kind of suffering, or there is suffering in death. We put death up there. Yeah. Confusion? Is that one? Did I hear that right? Yeah.
I'm making snap decisions.
Oh, pain, yeah. We got sickness, but we don't have pain.
Pointlessness.
Yeah. All right, two more. I have unfair and existential crisis. Jill wants to test your spelling. What did I miss right before existential crisis? It was
unfair.
Unfair. Okay. We can sort it out. We can sort it out. We can move them around.
Heartbreak.
It's Valentine's week. We can't have heartbreak. Okay. Now for our... So what categories do we think I've been choosing here?
People,
this one's kind of an obvious one. Physical... Yeah, pain, the really obvious suffering, as it's called, the suffering of suffering. Let's not get into the suffering of reading my handwriting. What do we think this includes? Heartbreak, unfair, jealousy, fear of the unknown, worry, loss, attachment, anxiety, depression, anger, loss of control, hatred, frustration, aversion, and death. What kind of suffering is that? Mental suffering? That's a good one. Mental, emotional. Well, this is the category in my hasty decisions here. That the Buddha called the suffering of change. Heartbreak, that person who once loved you no longer loves you. Fear of the unknown, that's definitely change. Loss is a change. Attachment, you're afraid of losing what you've got. I'm not sure where depression fits. Loss of control, that's a fear of change also. So what about this column? What might we be looking at here? Always wanting more, desire, fear of missing out, frustration, irritation, confusion, pointlessness, existential crisis. We in the developed world in the 21st century suffer a lot of this kind of suffering. This is what the Buddha called pervasive suffering.
Persuasive.
Persuasive, yes.
And so this is one of the reasons that the word suffering is not a very good word to categorize at all. Now I don't remember what I was going to say about it. Well, yeah, Geshe-la likes to use the word complications because all of these are complications in our lives. These are all the things that that are part of that unsatisfactory nature of our existence. You know, dissatisfaction. And pervasive suffering especially is dissatisfaction. So, do happy people suffer? Because? Yes, people said yes. So? Because suffering is life and things change. Tell me more about that.
Well, now we might need a mic.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
Sorry,
Susie.
Break's over.
Vacation's over.
Yeah. I while we're waiting on the mic, we heard suffering is life, and I have heard that it's kind of how suffering's gotten said in the West, but it's maybe better to say there is suffering. So to think of life is suffering is not actually, that's a little too far into that way of thinking. It's more like there is suffering. We're not suffering. You know, it's not intrinsic and absolute, but it's there. All right. So we had a comment over here.
The question was, if you're a happy person, can you still have suffering?
Mm-hmm.
And I said that yes, because things change. So I could be really happy, but life throws you a lot of challenges, and most people, unless they're enlightened, experience suffering, especially the suffering of change.
Yeah. Can you be suffering at the same time that you're happy? Okay, who said yes? Yeah, let's hear more.
Yeah, now you have to talk.
Awesome. So I would
hold up my mic.
Hello. I would consider myself a happy person, always trying to look on the positive, but that doesn't mean that things don't happen. When my mom passed away, it was like the most heartbreaking thing in the world, but it doesn't change the fact that I have beautiful children and I have a place to live and I have wonderful friends. So I have happiness in general, but things change in your life and they hurt at the time, but that doesn't take away the fact that you can always be happy.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Got a couple in the back.
I just had a clarifying question.
Uh-huh.
Can you define a happy person? What does that mean? Like, what is that?
Well, what do you think it means?
Well, I don't know.
I'm not a teacher. I'm just, you know.
I don't know because it's, you know, does it mean exclusively happy at all times or, you know, which probably doesn't exist.
That is the question. Can you be happy but also be suffering?
It's a more subtle, but one of the nuns here once talked about the feeling, you know, we're here for, let's say, a party. And we've had this wonderful party and we all feel closer. But as the party winds down, part of us want to cling to that party still going. We're all happy. We love, you know, the moment,
yeah.
But there's simultaneously the same feeling that this party's winding down and we know it's going to end. So are we happy? Yes. Are we also suffering in the same moment? I would say so.
Yeah. We'll add that. Go ahead, Joey.
The one thing that kind of I think of whenever we talk about pervasive suffering is the potential for suffering. Is that, you know, we have a body. And that means since we do have a body, that we have the potential to suffer. And that in itself is kind of pervasive. And it's even though we may be happy, if we have, since we have this, that it could always change to something that is not happy, you know, the potential for not to be happy.
Yeah, we had a couple others over here, Susie. Wait for the mic.
Trying to be happy.
Go ahead.
The mic. We have people who are streaming.
Does trying to be happy or, like, making it, a part of what you're looking for leave you to be more vulnerable to suffering?
That's a good question. Does trying to be happy make you more vulnerable to suffering?
I mean, because you're just allowing your openness to allow more in, which is going to include both, right?
Could. Yeah, that's
whereas
personal.
If you just maybe not even allowed yourself to even be happy, you would negate a lot of it.
Well, I think, again, that gets back to our definition of happiness, right?
Yeah,
is happy
yeah.
getting what you want in that moment, which Buddha would call suffering. So if, you know, there's a long-term happiness, which is more of a... it's not the ups and downs kind of happy that we think of happy now. So, like, I want this, I got it, now I'm happy. Like, that is, yeah.
Constantly being available to that experience.
So constantly being open can make you more vulnerable, make it more difficult in a way.
Exactly.
Certainly we need to pace ourselves, right?
Yeah. And I can actually relate to that because when my daughter entered my life as a little baby, suddenly I realized I'm vulnerable to suffering in a way that I hadn't been for a really long time, because as an adult, I had built all my defenses, which aren't 100% workable. But then here's this other person who's very innocent and vulnerable, who clearly is going to suffer sometime, and I will suffer when she suffers. So there's that. But that has to do with that suffering of change and that clinging. But that's a really good question.
I think happiness is being able to ride the waves instead of letting the waves pull you under. It's being able to, when difficulties arise, to view them with a calm and even mind, or put things in perspective, and be able to have the presence and calmness of mind to work it out instead of being overwhelmed by it.
We went in the front and then back.
That kind of leads me to my question.
Oh.
Being able to ride the waves may be a state of happiness, but is it wrong to suffer? I mean, so many of the things that I've enjoyed in life started out as suffering in the category that we put it, change. All the things that I take individual pride in, maybe, which may be selfish, but a lot of it is suffering. Like, and I can bro out to going to a gym, lifting weights. You're suffering, you're putting yourself through some sort of physical pain, but I enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
So is it wrong to enjoy suffering if it brings you happiness?
Is that actually suffering? Is that
well,
pain
causes,
that you're feeling at the gym, is that suffering or is that...
It hurts, and that goes into the physical.
It's the suffering of pain. Is it mental suffering?
Some mental suffering actually leads to happiness, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a conundrum for me.
Yeah. I don't know if wrong is the word I would use. I think it's possibly unavoidable to have some suffering, but that's a good question.
Is it possible to be suffering and not knowing it? Like, you're happy and you're suffering at the same time, but you don't know that you're actually suffering.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So
I'm hearing a lot of yeses. Does anybody want to expand on their answer to Octavia's question?
So to me, I think... I'm not going to generalize that everybody does this, but I think we have the idea of being happy, actually looking for happy moments, you know, but not necessarily meaning we're happy. We can be happy right now. We might not be having a happy moment.
Uh-huh.
And I think when we look for happiness, we're looking for happy moments, and we don't realize that we are actually happy.
Yeah. So we can have both then. We can have having suffering we don't really realize we're suffering, which I think a lot of that is that pervasive suffering, that kind of underlying mind of dissatisfaction where, everything is tinged with a little bit of corruption of our happy feelings. And then you've got the other side where you can have suffering, but there's always that happiness is still available. So that's great.
I have something. Okay. I'm reminded of that children's song, If You're Happy and You Know It, clap your hands.
back to is suffering like, okay, what your question was, going to the gym and experiencing pain. My personal experience is I've had some very difficult times in my life. And from those times have led to my happiest, to me being happier afterwards. As you were going through them, they seemed like they lasted forever and your life couldn't ever look happy again. And yet pushing through those things led me to deeper realization about who I am and my inner self, and eventually brought me to Kadampa Center. So I think that some of that suffering, without it, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
I would be just in my everyday pervasive suffering state.
Yeah. So suffering can be a diamond in the rough in a sense that, if we...
It leads to further growth, yeah.
So difficulties are inevitable, right? How we think about those difficulties might be suffering and it might be happiness. So if, and Jill's like, give him a definition of suffering, and I'm like, oh my gosh, how do I not have of happiness? Well, we should do both. also, I just want to put a plug in for Geshe Gelug really wants us to ask questions on Sunday morning. So these are some excellent questions. Questions like, well, doesn't suffering help us become better people, do this, do that? So he can give you really good definitions. So write down these questions because we want them on Sunday mornings. But I would say maybe think about the difference between the difficulty that is arising and your mental reaction to it. One that would lead you towards despair, one that leads you towards having courage and persistence, and those kind of reactions to the difficulty, that's not suffering. So, sorry to interrupt.
No, that's good. Okay, so let's move on to the second noble truth, which is, what is the origin of dukkha, of our unsatisfactory existence? So we can look at what's up here and think about what causes, well, actually somebody, we kind of hit on some of this here, there's proximate causes, mental and emotional causes for some of this kind of suffering. So let's just think about what are the causes and the origins of the different kinds of suffering that we have. Does anybody have any attachment? So what does attachment mean? Your happiness is
in things.
Your happiness is in things. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Any other thoughts about what causes our suffering?
Taking everything very personal.
Like the actions of others. Okay. Okay. Any other thoughts?
A lack of wisdom.
What kind of wisdom? Tell me more.
I think, when you're younger, you might look at things on a more superficial, shallow level, like this other person was saying earlier, we experience pain and suffering that might actually lead to growth and development and helps us mature and see things from a different perspective. And for me, that's wisdom. Being able to look at things in a deeper way.
Anyone else? A lack of awareness.
Other people's suffering.
other people's suffering?
Expectations.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay. So, well, we have other people suffering, and then we have our expectations. Oh, man, we're two behind. We have to do other people suffering, expectations, and then we'll get to do. Lack of compassion.
Lack of achievement or your own ability.
So we have another fear, and then lack of achievement or ability. Concern.
Concern.
Aversion. We didn't get aversion up there.
Yes, we have.
Yeah. Okay. Fair to all of our afflictions.
So these kind of fall into a couple of categories, I think. Some of them are proximate, very, you know, they're like immediate causes, like taking something personally, that's an immediate. Worrying about others suffering, that's immediate. Fear, concern, aversion, those are immediate things, you know. There's a hurricane coming and you don't know if your house is going to fall in. That's an immediate kind of suffering. Somebody hurts your feelings and you take it personally. That's an immediate cause of that suffering. But what are the causes behind why that fear of the hurricane, that pain from being insulted, that anxiety about other people who are suffering, what are the causes that go a little bit farther back than all of that? Yeah.
Grasping
for control. Uh-huh. Grasping for control of all those things. Grasping is a great Buddhist word. And why do we want to control those things? What else are we grasping at when we're trying to control those things?
Ego.
Ego, good. No, what I'm getting at is the reason all of these things cause us anxiety, cause us suffering, is what the text will call our fundamental confusion about how things really exist. That the reason we want to control events, our environment, our experiences, the reason we grasp at our ego, the reason all of these things cause us to suffer is because we don't understand how things really exist. And because of that, we do have attachment to things because we're clinging to that sense of ourselves. We have aversion because we're clinging to not being offended or not having something we don't like. And then those afflictive emotions lead us to create karmic actions. Joey's got a question before we go on.
Joey?
It sounds like that we are really wanting something that's more permanent, that we don't want things to change. And that's not how life goes. Everything changes most, you know. So I guess that's where the lack of awareness is the reality and so forth, is that we don't realize that we're interdependent and that there are causes and conditions for things to change, and things will change.
and part of
part of that suffering from change comes from that also not just a lack of understanding about the way things exist, but lack of understanding about causality, that all of these things that we've suffered, we do create. When Erin and I were preparing for this, she said a great thing. She was like saying, like, you know, we all kind of, or those of us who've been around for a little while, we've read and we've studied and we know about causality. And if we really believed, if we really, really had that, you know, solidly in us, we'd all have renunciation, but we still cling to all these other things because we don't have that real realization of causality and of the way things exist. And that's why we're here.
Still trying to figure it out.
Yeah. So does anybody have any more to say about the origins of suffering? Yeah.
Like biological, like evolutionary imprint that we're fighting with a lot of these sufferings that you have up there. They're biologically imprinted in our evolutionary thing to promote our species, and a lot of them may not really be relevant, and we're fighting that because it's something that's present in us without our like conscious control over it.
Boy, you get an A++ in Buddhism. And I would add not just biologically, but karmically, that we've got those imprints because...
So you're never going to get it because they're imprinted in there. It's like it's the hardware that you're fighting against.
But that's the beauty of karma, because karma moves in two directions. It's moving at us from our past, but we can also move it forward. And so the whole point of understanding karma is that we can start to change the way we think, the way we act, the way we react, and then by doing that, we start creating those karmic causes to have a better existence and to have less suffering, and eventually to be...
Fight our nature.
Well, in Buddhism, your true nature would be clear, light, knowing, positive, right?
Sure, and that's the conscious. That's the conscious part of you, but you're also fighting your biological animal part of you with a lot of these influences, right?
I don't know if fighting's the right word.
Trying to put it into
we have a lot of habits from the past that are easy to repeat, and the awareness of that and wanting to change it is not easy. It probably does feel like a fight, sure. Yeah.
And also think about, getting to sort of what our true nature is. I'm sure you've had the experience of when you do something that goes against that animal instinct, but it's a positive thing that you do. Maybe to put it in a really simplistic terms, there's one piece of pie left, the dog is going to eat that piece of pie and not going to care who else wants it. But you see someone else who wants that pie. Maybe it's somebody close to you. And so you don't do it because you love your wife or your child. Maybe it's somebody you don't know at all, which is kind of a little bit higher level of overcoming those basic instincts. And how does that feel? How does it feel when you do that?
Right.
It feels good. So we know that going against those basic animal instincts is not only possible, but it really feels good. So that's when we're getting to our higher selves and our truer nature. So
do we need to move on, or we have a comment in front?
Let's take one more comment and then we'll move on.
So in response to what you're saying, we're hardwired with a negative bias. So we're wired to think of the worst case scenario. They say something like, you need, five positive things to offset a negative thing. So we're wired that way. We're wired to find the negative, and I think that's the suffering. We're wired to look for it in general. So, I think it's about trying to get to a different level so that you can add the positive enough times to get kind of to the other side of the fence.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get into cessation.
And first of all, raise your hand if you think that we actually can end our suffering. Okay. Keep your hands up.
Not sure.
There's some
of the same people are also.
And then, if you really, really, really believe that in your gut and have renunciation, keep your hand up. Yeah. Oh, okay. We've got two. Good. Yeah. All right. So let's just have a little meditative exercise in imagining what it might look like to experience the cessation of suffering. So we'll get comfy in that meditative pose. Your back straight, your spine lengthened a little bit. There's room for the energy to flow. Feet flat on the floor or gently crossed. And as you relax, just get the feeling that all your cares and worries are starting to fade in significance. They might still be there, but they're not as prominent. And just get a feel for that. Imagine living a life without any desires, without any clinging. You have no wish for nice clothes, for a new car, for the latest iPhone. No need for fine food or entertainment. No desire for that promotion at work. No need to have others appreciate you or notice your contributions or admire you. No need to have friends who support you emotionally or reflect back your lovableness. No need even to be loved. You are absolutely content no matter what happens. If it rains on your wedding day out in the gardens, that's okay. Your car breaks down on I-40 in rush hour on a Friday after 5 on a 3-day weekend. That's just what's happening. You win the Mega Millions lottery. That's okay. Your partner of 15 years leaves you. You feel calm. You're diagnosed with a life-threatening disease. Your mind is serene, ready to move forward. Whatever happens, your mind is like a still lake.
events and experiences flit across the surface like a dragonfly, touching here and there, but barely making a ripple. Everything is absolute peace and tranquility. Okay, now gently bring your mind back to the room. I think we can do it.
Yeah.
So the texts say that when we eradicate our fundamental ignorance, then we do get that end of suffering, and that leads to peace. And that peace leads to a bliss that's beneficial to us, and then we get that absolute, permanent, unchanging, ultimate release. Okay. Now we're going to
run over to the fourth.
Turn it over to Karen and take it away.
So I wanted to answer Jill's question. Just give us a definition of happiness. Why don't you? I'm like, I don't know. Happiness is the absence of suffering. I know it's not what we think of happiness, but here's what Lama Zopa Rinpoche says. I think the most important thing is that you're happy, not just in the Western way, feeling happy with excitement and attachment, but inner happiness. I'm talking about the happiness you can develop from life to life up to enlightenment. This happiness can be complete, so it is meaningful. Whatever you do in the world, this is the essence. This happiness is Dharma. It is a happiness that can be continued and developed. So it's not a very glossary type definition, but there isn't a glossary type definition in my quick search. And you know, it has a lot to do with how we're reacting. And so, again, the difficulties are the difficulties. Suffering is on top of that, right? So all of these challenges in our life, that you guys talked about, if they take us down and cause us a deep depression and we have no way, no tools, no opportunities to move forward from that, then that is suffering, and that's typically mixed with all of these positive things that we, and ways that we react to. So I would agree, you know, with difficulties that gives us opportunities. But it's not wrong to suffer. And that's not, I don't think what we're saying. We're saying that's kind of where we're at. We're observing that that's where we're at. But most of us are looking forward to the cessation of that, like we just experienced.
Yeah. And our suffering is a tool. In fact, it is said that having a human life is the best kind of life you can have, rather than being either in a God realm or in the lower realms, because in a human life you have that unique combination of suffering and intelligence. So you've got that suffering that's a motivator that's urging you, I want to get the heck out of here. I don't like this. I don't like it. And then you have the intelligence that you can start finding tools to apply to end the suffering. So yes, it's suffering can actually be not beneficial in itself, but it can be a tool to use to move us away from it.
Okay, now we can do the fourth noble truth. The path that leads to the cessation. So I just wanted to mention this book because we haven't mentioned it yet. I think Donna and I both looked at this book. I definitely did. If I say anything useful, it's probably from Geshe Tashi Tsering. If I say anything confusing, that's from me. So there you go. So the last noble truth is one that encompasses your entire spiritual journey. So this is what we need to undertake to be free from suffering. 84,000 teachings the Buddha had, right? So they say it's the path, right? The path that leads to cessation. So I don't want to get too off on a tangent, but if you ask a Theravadan master what is the path, they would talk about Noble Eightfold Path. And if you read books from other traditions, which most of us do, even if we're primarily studying here, you've seen Noble Eightfold Path, but you don't hear Noble Eightfold Path in from our Tibetan masters or their students. The path, when a Tibetan master says it, is the path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, no more learning. So basically, one, the first is kind of like, here are the different, the Eightfold Path, here are the different topics you could learn at university. And the other is like undergraduate, graduate, postdoctorate kind of level. So they're organized a little bit differently, but they are Buddhist teachings. But the other, so I wanted to mention Noble Eightfold Path, even though we don't talk about it because it's not a thing. It's just organized a bit differently. But another thing that we always hear when we hear path is Lamrim. Lamrim, Lamrim. Lamrim is the graduated path. So what is Lamrim? Lamrim is a textual tradition. So, but it organizes Buddhist teachings into these steps. And so the first master who did this was Lama Atisha. That's why we have his statue up here, in the 11th century. So when Buddha said the path to cessation, he wasn't saying Lamrim because it was organized 1,000 years later, right? But, of course, the Four Noble Truths are encompassed in the Lamrim. So those 84,000 teachings, the Four Noble Truths was the first one of them. And it is organized in this Lamrim, which we talk about when we say the path a lot. Hopefully I'm being clear and not making it more confusing. And then we have a lot of times some references that we go to Lama Tsongkhapa, who wrote the Lamrim Chenmo, or gave the Lamrim Chenmo, is probably written down later. And then Pabanka Rinpoche did a teaching that was recorded in Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. So when we say the path in that way, the graduated path of Lamrim, it's referring to one original teaching outline and then all the commentaries on that. I think we have a tendency around here to go, oh, the Lamrim. Well, what does that mean? It's kind of this all-encompassing thing based on Mama Atisha. And then going forward. Is that clear as mud? No mud, no lotus, right? okay. So that's how I'm going to talk about the path without giving you guys any real teachings on that. So, okay. Daily difficulties. So it's said that it's impossible to have a desire for samsara, like all these great samsara things that make us happy for a short amount of time, and the desire to be free, completely free from samsara at the same time. You hear this a lot, but you can't hold these two opposing things at exactly the same time. So even though I'm going to talk a little bit about daily difficulties, we don't want to lose sight of that real big goal that we have, trying to get out of samsara. We're not trying to perfect samsara and go, well, let's just make everything controlled and perfect here. We want to hold that big idea in mind. And I like how this is said, in searching for a path that leads to liberation and enlightenment, we look for a way to deal with the afflictive emotions that have been with us since we first started to interact with other beings. So since we first started, and probably without other beings around, I mean, I'm perfectly capable of having afflictive emotions when there's no one else in the room, right? But sometimes they're very helpful, other beings, in helping us develop our afflictive emotions. So before we reach that complete cessation, before we get to the point where we've really given up samsara, we need ways to deal with our daily difficulties. There's a book up there. It's a cover of a book that I didn't read, but I did listen to a podcast where it's like that Holiday Inn Express, right? I didn't read the book, but I listened to a podcast where the author was talking, and I thought she made a couple interesting points. I think it's just, for me it's helpful to bring these teachings, to study them in, you know, the profound and precise way that we might hear from a master or geshe, but also to kind of think about them in a day-to-day way. And that's what she did, and I think that's lovely to really kind of say, how am I going to use this in a day-to-day life? So, again, ultimate aim, always going beyond that. So her book is The Noble Truth of Love, and Dawn already said it's Valentine's Week. But we can think, you know, a lot of our relationships have some similar things, especially if we have a roommate, if we're trying to live with somebody, if we're trying to share an office with them at work. You know, these relationships have some things in common of difficulties that might arise. So we're going to look at these daily difficulties and see if the first noble truth applies. Is there anything in relationships that causes dissatisfaction? Anything at all? We've got snoring. So I would say you could call it out if it's a short thing, and I can repeat it. If you want to raise your hand, we can give you the mic. So snoring is a way we experience suffering in relationships. Anything else? Jealousy? Mm-hmm.
Unmet expectations.
Unmet expectations, yes.
Finances.
Yep.
Lack of compassion
sometimes, yeah.
You're in my space.
You're in my space. Oh, space is a big one. Noise is a big one for me. Why are you making so much noise? Why are you eating like that? Why are you breathing like that? You know, like... My husband helped me practice this whole thing before I came, so that was fun.
Control.
Wanting to be in control. Feeling like you need control.
Feeling like you're being controlled.
All of them. All the control ones. Misunderstanding.
Communication.
Imbalance of power. Yeah.
Divergent goals.
Yeah. Blame, guilt,
shame.
Great. So that's why we keep having relationships. But as we talked about, we need a few difficulties to work with, right? So the way that Susan Piper put this was that relationships never stabilize. So it's... The way she's saying it is like when one problem goes away, another one arises. There's no way to really get comfortable. At the beginning, what are relationships like at the beginning? Like, let's just talk about the love relationship, or even like your brand new office mate that you're so excited to meet. What are they like at the beginning?
Pink.
Hmm?
Pink.
Pink?
Pink.
Nice. Yeah. Pink. Yeah. Okay. Nice. Happy. Exciting, yes.
Maybe a bit nervous.
Yes, you're nervous when you meet a new friend or have a new kind of... You can be nervous in a good way.
Fresh.
Exciting.
You don't know the gunk yet.
So someone had said something about being happy. Well, like, should we try to not be happy? And after doing this for a long time, sometimes I kind of do. I'm like, oh, best not to get too excited, you know, because... What goes up must come down, right? So it's not that we want to, it makes Buddhist sound like so much not fun, but not that we want to say, don't get excited, but maybe don't cling to that excitement. So there is some, don't ever exaggerate. Yeah. So that's what relationships are like in the beginning. Now, what are they like 5, 10, 15 years later? Yeah.
A bit annoying.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially.
Stagnant.
Monotonous.
Hopefully loving and peaceful.
That too. It absolutely is. And a lot of times, you know, if a relationship does last all these numbers of years, and you know, then there's a core underlying thing. I have, you know, friends that I've been friends with since high school. And that's been a while. So, you know, but there's been phases in those relationships where we weren't as close. But there's this kind of underlying probably respect, compassion, kindness, willing to work on things. Yeah. But, you know, if people've been tapping their fork since you met them, they're the same way. They're probably not going to stop doing that. And then new things come up too. So that these are just her words, and this is not Buddhist teachings. This is just, you know, a Buddhist practitioner putting some words out there to try to kind of say, well, how can I use this? So what are the causes of our frustrations, feelings of irritation, and things like that? Does the second noble truth apply, that Buddha said that there's a cause? These causes in our second noble truth were afflictive emotions, attachment, aversion, fundamental ignorance. Yeah, those things? Same things? Oh yeah, do it. We'll give you the mic for this one because I think you're on.
You're just trying to change everybody else, and when you first start a relationship, like I said, there's a saying in Romanian that says it's all pink. I didn't realize I was in the U.S.
Romanian.
Yeah, it's a Romanian thing that says
rosy.
It's all rosy. It's all nice and pink. But then we have an attraction towards someone. There's physical, there's an emotional attraction. And then as we see the truth, right, we try to change the truth. And that's never really, you know, never really going to work, because we are what we are. We have that karma background that we each carry. And instead of focusing on our peace and the way we react, right, there's also a saying that says, there's no stress in this life, just people thinking stressful thoughts. Mm-hmm. So once you don't, and you really set up your mind and you say, okay, I'm going to love this person regardless what this person is going to turn into, right? That's what the marriage is. You sign something actually saying, I'm going to put up with bad and good. And that's really changing your mind towards, yeah, I'm just going to have a relationship. It's all going to be great. If it's not, you know, then we're just going to move on. It's rather accepting who you are and accepting who that person is, just living the moment as it is, right, with that person and not trying to change anything, and being compassionate towards the other person. And if something happens, just accept it the way it is.
Right. Yeah, you jumped all the way into, like, how do we make this work? But excellent. So so the way that Susan Piver wrote it was, expecting relationships to be stable is what makes them unstable. But by unstable, I think she kind of means uncomfortable, right? So we're always trying to get rid of problems, but we're kind of always expecting to not have problems, like in the rom-coms, you know, or whatever it is. And then I think she's going to win the microphone back. Then explaining that, and it's not a problem to fix problems, but expecting that's going to make you happy. Okay, I fixed that problem, now I'm going to be happy. This is kind of what we do over and over again. Fix that, now I can relax, now I can be happy, now I got that done, is kind of what she's looking at. And of course, the idea here is not in the extremes, right? We're not talking about very toxic situations. We're not talking about abusive situations. We're talking about just the kind of regular relationship type problem.
I think there's a very common mistake in labeling things as problems, right? Because I can see getting into a car accident as a problem, while the other person next to me can say, well, it's just a car accident, let's just see the positive thing that we're on, right? So we keep on labeling, this is bad. Our children do something and we say, no, it's not okay, it's bad, right? Our partners do something or snore or eat, you know, and we label them into our head as being something that's bad. So I think also the rewiring of the brain really works once you start thinking instead of thinking they're negative, you think they're positive, and you can actually see a change in the way things appear outside from your inner labeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so snoring is maybe an example of that. You can say this is a problem. I have to, so so clearly I'm allowed to be annoyed and frustrated and I'm losing sleep and like that, or it's like, well, this is a noise, this is the type of breathing, this
yeah.
is, and but you can label it a different way.
In the initiative chapters of a relationship, you deal with that snoring because it's interesting and you just met that person. But after 5 years, it turns into it's the same thing, it's the same person, but the way you label it and the way you react to it has changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And ultimately, this is all about for ourselves, for our own minds, of how we can react to these things. So what time do we need to end? Are we? Okay. At 11:55. Okay, sorry. All right. So what I was thinking about for the next one. Oh no, that's my joke. Okay. sorry. So getting into the third noble truth, which I was thinking we could do small group discussion, but do we have time to break out? We don't have time to break out. That's fine. We're doing pretty good with big group discussion. The third noble truth has to do with the idea that we can change how things are by changing how we think about them. So we've already kind of started talking about this anyway. And the fourth has to do with our methods. So can we imagine relationships where we feel less discomfort? I had an office mate at one point, and I would do Tonglen meditation, and it really changed my experience in having a relationship with my office mate. What thoughts and speech and actions lead to more happiness in our relationships? So we've already been talking about this a little bit. But we have a couple minutes if anybody else has anything they want to share. Roy, you have some?
Can I?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure.
Thank you for the teachings today. So I have a question because I heard a report about a Buddhist community in the United States, an immigrant community, and it was framed in mental health and some mm-hmm. of the difficulties mental health practitioners do to have to, you know, improve the conditions of that community. And I just want to, you know, I don't know how to frame this question. Framing or reframing the situation, you know, you said, of course, this doesn't mean a toxic relationship or something. So all of these can have extremes, and how do you balance that out when you're trying to follow the path, the
yeah.
teaching?
Well, you have to be careful, you know. You have to use wisdom. You might need to seek professional help. Go ahead.
Having done a journey through some mental health issues myself, it's difficult to know where the line is, but pretty consistently the monks will say, you know, seek treatment first. Meditation's not a solution for mental health challenges. It's not really a solution for toxic relationships. Get yourself well, get yourself safe first. Start on the path to wellness. Then when you're in a more clear pace, I hear a lot of, you know, questions about absolutes. Remember that the Buddha, one of his key things was, it's a middle way. So, you know, find, be safe, start to heal, then the meditation comes.
Thank you for that answer. Jill, do you have one?
Someone just told me last week that it struck me to let others sit in discomfort. And that was huge. Like if our children are suffering or if someone else is suffering, that we can't, you know, try to fix everything. And so to let someone else, they have to suffer to get to, like what Hetty said, they have to suffer to get to where they want to go. So in relationships and everything that we interact, how much, you know, that line of how much do we save and how much do we, if the bug is drowning, we're going to save it. We don't say you're learning something here, just keep swimming harder. But, you know, the child has to learn how to swim, right? So you have to find that line constantly without suffering yourself while you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really difficult. But to just know that you can't fix everything and that you are trying to just define your happiness, define all those things at the same time.
Does that help a little bit, Royden?
Oh, yeah.
Good. All right, I'll do my joke and then... Why don't Buddhists, oh, do you guys already know this one? Jill knows it. Why don't Buddhists, they never, yeah, oh, okay. They have no attachment. So that's all we need to do. Just get rid of our attachments. I have this you, and then I do that, and then you do that.
That's after we do the prayers.
After the prayers.
Well, we can do that now and then. Okay.
We can do it. Jill said we could do it before prayers this time. Okay. Should be quick.
Jill said we can make announcements before we do prayers. I'm so excited. I'm teasing.
We have 8 minutes.
Yeah, so I'll take off my facilitator hat and put on my SBC announcer hat. And there's actually several exciting things coming up this week. Tomorrow night is a discussion group called Taking It to Heart. And it's an opportunity for a couple of weeks on Monday night between our Discovering Buddhism sessions to come in and have a discussion like we had today, you know, very open-ended and just talk with people at all kinds of levels of experience in the Dharma about different things. And what is the topic tomorrow night? Do you remember?
Anxiety and depression.
Anxiety and depression.
But what
Let's
we
go.
Do to counteract those things.
Right. How we counter them. And then Tuesday, right now we're in the middle of a two-week period of Buddha holy days, the days of miracles, they're called, and so they're really great auspicious days to do practice. And so Tuesday is the last of those days. And so on Tuesday we're going to have two sutra reading sessions, group sutra reading. That sounds really boring, but it's really fun. We do it monastery style, which means we've got like this maybe 20 or 30 page sutra, and everybody in the room gets a couple of pages, and we all read aloud at the same time, and it's you're getting, even if you're not consciously hearing what the person next to you is saying, it's still entering into your mind, because we know from science that our brains are able to do a lot. So we're getting this great imprint of these teachings. So we're going to have one at noon and one at 7. I think noon is the Saggata Sutra and 7 is the Golden Light Sutra. And then this coming weekend, Venerable Amy Miller is coming for a weekend visit. She's going to be teaching on thought transformation, which is kind of how we use the grist of that suffering and turn it into, you know, the cessation. So she's got this great title, Awakening the Warrior Within. So she'll be here Friday from 7 to 9 p.m., Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 with a lunch break. And we always encourage people to bring a bag lunch so we can sit around and talk about all the exciting ideas we heard in the morning. Sunday morning she'll be teaching here, and it won't be the workshop, but she'll be covering our Sunday morning session. And in the afternoon she'll conclude the workshop. And so that's going to be very exciting, and I encourage you all to come, and I encourage you all to volunteer in different ways. And if you are interested in driving Venerable Amy to and from any of these events, please see Susie.
Or email me.
Okay. I still got it. Joey. Oh, I'm going to finish up about Venerable Amy. Do you have a ground? Okay. So having Venerable Amy here is a rare opportunity. It is so helpful to have the experience of a Western teacher to give a perspective on the Dharma, because that teacher, the Western teachers, the visiting teachers, often share a lot of the same experiences that we have. And yet they've done a tremendous amount of study and practice. And so they can kind of connect those things for us. What allows us to invite those teachers here and to not have people buy tickets, charge when they come in the door, things like that, is sponsorships. So the way that you can see on the door when you can come in, those are all people that have given something and had a dedication for the generosity. So we accept all kinds of sponsorships, any level. We accept donations at any level. The official sponsorships start at $75. and you get an invitation to the sponsor tea at that level. I feel like I'm on NPR. It also kind of goes to the tradition that was started 2,500 years ago with Buddha, where the regular people like us support the Dharma existing and continuing to exist by supporting those who are doing that level of study and practice and teaching. So it's a great opportunity for us to ensure that the next people in line have opportunities for the Dharma. If you have any questions about like actually how to make a sponsorship, you can talk to Jill. Donna, I think, gave us a great information about Vulnerable Amy, but if you have more questions, she can answer. Go to our account. This is how I do it. Go to the calendar or go to the webpage, click on Vulnerable Amy, and all the links are there. You can donate, you can sign up to volunteer, and you can register to come to the teaching, which isn't required, but it's nice and helpful, and it helps us with like how many handouts and stuff. So give us all that information. You know, if you're coming, you know, make the commitment to fill some water bowls or something like that. Or just say, what can I do to help when you get here? It really is nice for all of us who volunteer to be part of a community like that. Joey. Do we have more announcements other than Joey? Should we do both those before prayers?
Okay.
So I'm Joey. I'm one of the Serenity Gardeners. Usually on the last Saturday of each month, we have a grounds day and everything. But due to the fact that Venerable Amy is going to be coming, we don't want you to have any kind of conflicts or anything like that. So we're postponing our grounds day till afterwards. So please, please, please come and see Venerable Amy. She's a wonderful teacher, wonderful teacher.
I'm Elise from Outreach. The Kadampa Center is affiliated with the Triangle Interfaith Alliance. And this Thursday evening at 6 o'clock, we're having our annual dinner, which provides you with an opportunity to experience different nonprofits in the area, like North Carolina Committee of Refugees and Immigrants, Habitat for Humanity, Hope International, Stop Hunger Now. It's an opportunity for you to practice the essential Buddhist teachings of, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want yourself to be happy, practice compassion. By coming to this dinner, you will learn how service will feed your soul and feeds that of others, how just a little moment of your time can make such an impact in the lives of others. So officially, the last sign-up RSVP date was last Friday, but if you really want to go, you can respond today. If you can respond by today, we need to know the numbers for the dinner. And there's little slips of paper by the back door and also as you come in if you want the information. Thank you.
I just forgot. Next Sunday, I'll be leaving for 2 weeks. I just thought I'd better tell you guys that the center won't be open. I didn't think about that. So it'll be open a little bit with Amanda here, but those hours are a little fluctuating. And should we post that? I'll put it on the door. Is that the best place to do it? Or send an email out maybe or something. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to let you know.
Okay. Well, it's been a great morning. And let's take a minute now and dedicate our merit. So we'll go to page 246 in the gold prayer book, or on the back of the prayer sheet in a white binder. And we'll read from Master Shantideva's Bodhicaryavatara. I finally learned to say that. One syllable at a time. Okay, sorry.
May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit.
May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. And now turn to the previous page and we'll say a couple of short long life prayers. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Now the bottom of the facing page, the one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatari, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. And then back over. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And now seven green Tara mantras for the long, happy, healthy lives of our precious Geshe's. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha.